This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today is the actual day of the 20th anniversary of the national daily broadcast of Fresh Air. We've been commemorating that anniversary all week by playing back some of Terry's interviews from 20 years ago, and we have more of them today. We even have one that predates the anniversary. But for starters, we have Terry's 1987 interview with blues and jazz historian Sam Charters. He's one of the people who helped make possible the blues revival of the 1950s and 60s. Some of the musicians who were at the forefront of that revival first had their work brought to the public by Charters. He's a white northerner who, as a young man, became fascinated by southern black music. During most of the 50s, he was based in Louisiana and traveled around the South making field recordings of forgotten or previously undiscovered performers. He's produced hundreds of albums of folk and blues, including this 1968 recording of guitarist and singer Buddy Guy. In the mid to late 60s, Sam Charters was the head of A&R at Vanguard Records, where he produced the great anti-war hit, I Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die Rag, by Country Joe and the Fish. When Terry spoke to him in 1987, she asked Sam Charters how he was first introduced to blues and jazz.
I'm one of those people who grew up in a family that had discovered jazz in the mid-20s. My father and my uncles had played in an amateur high school band. And in 1926, they were playing at a little lake in Michigan, playing arrangements of dance songs of the period. And someone said to them, well, you guys are okay, but you should hear the band at the next lake. So they went up to the next lake, and there was the Hoagie Carmichael Band playing jazz. And my family to this day has not recovered from it. And they instantly became jazz musicians. And so I just grew up with all of this. One of my aunts married a trumpet player who'd come out of Electra, Texas, with the whole Ray McKinley and that group. And so people would check in the house. Teagarden would be there hanging up on the clothes hanger because he was too drunk to stand up. And there were band rehearsals going on. And my uncles would disappear, and they would go off and turn out they'd hitchhike to New York to see who the latest trumpet player was in the Duke Ellington band. And I assumed everybody lived this way. At the same time, they were deeply involved in Béla Bartók's music, and they were deeply involved in theater. And there was just all of this going on. My uncles, when they were trying to court a girl, would play Bessie Smith records for them, which didn't go over very well, but they certainly went over very well with me. And it wasn't until I was really in my late teens that I discovered that what I'd had as a background was really very, very unusual.
Well, you spent your life in search of music. In the 1950s, you moved from the North to the South, based yourself in Louisiana, and started making field recordings of Southern blues musicians and singers. Why did you want to go specifically to the South, and why were you interested in blues? It was jazz that you were brought up on.
That's right, and absolutely, if you were interested in jazz at that time, New Orleans was the city to go because it was still alive. So I began playing clarinet with my own jazz band when I was 13 and really wasn't very good and was looking for models. And I always was very determined if I wanted to do something, I did it. So I went to New Orleans as a teenager and looked up a man there named George Lewis. And George, for $5, would let me sit in the kitchen with him and we'd play two clarinet duets for hours. And we'd play a tune like High Society, and I'd play the melody, and George would show me 30 ways to play the chorus. And I'd read every word that you could read about jazz, and since I'd grown up with it, I thought I knew a lot. And then one day I met George on the street in the French Quarter. He was with Jim Robinson, this wonderful trombone player, George and Jim, and they were all dressed up. And I said, where have they been? They'd been to a funeral. Who had died? A trumpet player. I said, wonderful trumpet player, Big Bammoth, trumpet player from the 20s. I'd never heard of him. And I'd read every word on jazz that had ever been published. So that night when I went to see George before the job, he always rested, so he was lying in his bed resting, and I sat at the foot of the bed, and he began telling me about all the history of jazz that we'd never known anything about. And suddenly I realized that this is what I was going to try to find out about. So for the next 7 years, I lived in New Orleans, on and off traveling at the same time, interviewing all the musicians, the black musicians who'd ever played there.
Did you have specific musicians you were going in search of, maybe musicians whose records you had on 78 RPMs and who'd never been heard of for the past 30 years?
Well, the ones I was looking for hadn't even been recorded, most of them. In New Orleans, it was all legends. You knew that there was someone Louis Armstrong had learned from, and you'd heard Louis, but who was the one he learned from? Buddy Petit, and Buddy Petit had never made a record. So it became a wonderful, intense search for ghosts, looking for men who died many years before, trying to catch an echo of what their music must have been like. I tried to find every living member of the first jazz band, the Muddy Bolden Band, trying to get them to hum me their trombone parts, hum me the part that the guitar player plays, trying desperately to get to something that was lost, something that was lost forever. But we still had a chance to get a glint of it, get some little memories of it somehow or other.
What kind of equipment would you take with you when you were going to record somebody performing?
When I first started recording, this is marvelous, it becomes sort of like the history of early photography. People don't realize the struggles we had. The early machines in the late 40s, which I couldn't afford, were simply wind-ups that had a heavy flywheel and always ran down. And then you could possibly get a new thing called a wire recorder, but they got all tangled up and had very low fidelity. And then you could get tape recorders, which was brand new. So I bought my first tape recorder in 1953, one of the very first cheap models, had a little green eye that blinked at me. And the eye closed when I played two things too loudly on it. And and it must have weighed, sometimes I thought it weighed several hundred pounds, but I carried the damn thing for 5 or 6 years, and I did 35, 40 records with it. I had a microphone that I stuck with me, and I hitchhiked around with that damn thing. And it wasn't until finally I went to Africa in 74 that I was able to take a really good battery-operated stereo tape recorder with me.
Well, you were traveling around the rural South. Did you always have electricity to plug the tape machine into?
In 1954, I'd heard of a group called the Mobile Strugglers, which was one of the last real, genuine skiffle bands in the South, playing with washboards and washtub bass and everything. So I went over, and I was very inexperienced, but I had my tape recorder, and I managed to get the washtub bass player out of jail, where he'd gone from drunk and disorderly, and managed to track the guys down. We were in a little shack neighborhood outside of Mobile, back in the sort of the woods, and I was looking for some place to plug in my tape recorder, because I had to plug it in, and the fellow said, well, there's a house right there. I know those people. We'll go in there. So we went in and, of course, plugged in and everything, and I used the people's ironing board for the microphone stand. Of course, they didn't know anybody lived there. We'd simply broken into somebody's house. And the people came in later in that afternoon, and here was this recording session going on with the tape recorder, and by that point, we'd managed to find some beer. I was incredibly embarrassed, but they were very, very kind about it. They understood, danced along with the playbacks. We had a great afternoon.
You've also discovered musicians who no one, aside from local people, knew about before.
Oh, yeah.
One of them was Lightnin' Hopkins.
That's right.
Who's very familiar, I think, to people who listen to blues now. How did you first hear about him?
Well, it was impossible to not hear the blues as a jazz musician, even though we tried to keep the two separate as early as the late 40s, the jazz groups I was playing with, we had one or two blues records that we would listen to, even though we knew nothing about it, nothing. And I heard over the radio. I was part of the black community in the early 50s, and the radios were on, and I'd hear Lightnin' Hopkins, who was a figure somewhere out of Texas, who was making some records for a funny little record company called Gold Star, which then went out of business. Lightnin' disappeared. But I always ate in a same sort of rundown restaurant in the French Quarter. And turned out, I was talking one day about Lightnin' Hopkins, and the cook said, that's my cousin. And he at least directed me to Houston. And then once I got in the Houston ghetto, after about 3 days of asking around, I found a sister who didn't know anything. Found a place where his guitar was in pawn. They didn't know anything. And finally, I was sitting in my car at a street corner, and a car pulled up beside me, and a man rolled down the window and said, you looking for me? And I said, you Lightnin'? And he said, that's right. So I rented a guitar for him, got a bottle of gin. We went back to the little shabby room where he was living, and we made his first LP.
What was it like?
was marvelous. I'd never heard anything quite like it in my life. Lightning went on and did hundreds of records, some of them losing the intensity. But for me, this was the first time he'd had a chance to stretch out without time limits, to simply do a range of songs. So he wasn't having to worry about starting on time, stopping on time. I was sitting there with the microphone right in front of him, so he could simply be free. And he'd always been working with an electrical guitar, and I'd rented him an acoustic. So he was playing with music he was hearing himself in a marvelous way. And for me, I'd come closer, I think, to the genesis of the blues than I'd ever come before, because Lightning was such an extraordinary artist.
Now, how old was he at this time?
Lightning would have been, been 49. I think born in 1910, I believe.
Now, we have a recording standing by of Lightning Hopkins. Yeah. Is this from that first session?
That's right.
That
is from the first song he did, the Penitentiary Blues, where he took the old work song about Ain't No More Cane in This Brazos and turned it into a blues.
Penitentiary Blues. Time for another man. When it haven't been a thing poor Lightning done. They say you ought to been on Brady 19 and 10, but Russell drove pretty women just like he did ugly miss. I'm Big Brad. Yes, here I come. Finna do time for another man, and ain't nothing poor Lightning done. Well, you ought to be ashamed.
Lightning Hopkins recorded in 1959. I guess when you were recording the session with Lightning Hopkins that you weren't disappointed.
I couldn't believe it. Absolutely couldn't believe it, because I had, in all these years, been looking for the beginnings, been looking for the roots, which meant I was always working with older musicians. And quite often, even when they were playing for me, I was only getting a memory of what they had played like when they were young. And this was the first time I'd met someone really just at the height of his creative powers, someone who had the imagination, had the flow and the vitality.
Sam Charters, speaking to Terry Gross in 1987. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1987 interview with musicologist Sam Charters.
You were living in the black community in Louisiana and traveling in black circles in the South.
Right.
This was the 1950s. The South was still segregated. You must have really stuck out a lot, one of the few people probably in black circles at that time, and one of the few white people in black circles in the South at that time.
It was always complicated because racism was an official policy of these small communities. It wasn't that simply people were prejudiced. It was simply the law. I was arrested a lot. I was picked up a lot. And I was scared a lot. Every person I talked to was immediately questioned by the local sheriff, the deputies afterwards. I remember I was looking for Robert Johnson in Mississippi, and I talked to a couple of people on a street in just one of the little towns there, Friars Point. And I got down to the end of the corner, and I was looking at my map, and I looked back, and a deputy had both the persons I'd talked to up against a tree. And all I simply asked them for was directions. But I was not a car they recognized, and I was white. Only wanted. So I always had to be very careful. not only for my own sake, but for the sake of the people I talked with. In New Orleans, it was quite literally illegal for me to shake hands with a black musician on the street. And the streetcars were still with those damn signs you moved up and down saying white, black, you know, segregated, and you had to move them up and down. And if you tried to do anything against it, you simply got people in trouble. And so when I'd go with the musicians into a bar, they'd always have to, into a black bar, they'd always have to pass me off as a full-blooded Indian. They may look white, but he's a full-blooded Indian.
Well, that comment that you just made reminds me, too, that I wonder if you've ever felt at times like you were in an awkward position with a black musician you were recording, because especially in the 1950s when you were finding people who were really down on their luck a lot, who were poor, who hadn't, no one knew who they were, no one knew about their talents. They'd been in and out of prison, maybe. So you're coming from a more, you know, advantaged, privileged background. You have the money to give them, and, mm-hmm. and so on. It's not exactly a position of equality. And when you have this political sense that you're, that's motivating your work, mm-hmm. you can really feel the unevenness of a relationship like that. How would you deal with that?
Well, there was no way to deal with it, because there was no way that they could understand enough of me or my background to in any way comprehend the complex nature of this. And also, they were very religious, most of them, and deeply conservative politically, and that here was someone who was essentially irreligious and rather radical coming down and doing this for his own reasons. So they simply regarded me as a white recording boss. And the only possible relationship most of the time was that. And of course, there were. I was endlessly trying to make it friendship, but it couldn't be. You know, it would have been some of them wonderful ones like Big Joe Williams and things, they totally understood that they totally didn't understand.
Have people who've read your books, especially your new book, or heard your records, assumed that you were black?
Most do. And this has been difficult. It's been such a difficult point that for part of the 70s, I decided I would do no more work in the field of black music. So I didn't do anything from 70 until 73. Expecting that a young black scholar would step in and do this kind of historical work, but because of the sensitivity involved, none did. So back I went and started again. And there were a series of books in the 70s, again, documenting the blues, documenting black music. But no, I had always felt this kind of sensitivity. But I the only thing that really put it in perspective for me was after my first blues book came out, The Country Blues, I was at a party with the Folkways office, and there was Langston Hughes. And Langston was telling me how much he liked the book. And I said, Langston, thank you, but you could tell me so much more about the blues than I'll ever know. And Langston looked at me and said, tell me something about Schubert that I don't know. And I realized at that point that this is simply something to learn about, and that it didn't matter what color or what your background was. If you set out to learn it and you were open, you could learn. And so this has been my final justification for continuing to absorb myself in it. Absolutely, there may be nuances I miss, but after all these years, there are a lot of nuances that I get, and I'll settle for that.
Sam Charters, speaking to Terry Gross in 1987.